speech that was recognizably human. My three companions answered in the same language, and the exchange was obviously a pleasant one. We didn't linger long at that low altitude, however, as some of the horsewomen soared to such heights, they almost touched our vehicle, thereby risking injury to themselves. The plain we flew over was, in places, embossed with small knolls, all of about the same size. I remarked on them and Biastra explained that, millions of years ago, these knolls had been volcanoes. The vegetation below us had none of the exuberance of the forest I had experienced on my arrival. On the contrary, here the trees were grouped in small stands, reaching no more than 25 meters in height. As we passed, large white birds took flight by the hundreds, only to land again, a safe distance away. A wide water course flowed to the horizon, dissecting the plain with its lazy wanderings. I could make out some small dokos grouped together on a bend of the river. Tau guided the Latavok above the river, reducing altitude to water level as we approached the settlement. We landed in a small square between two dokos and were immediately surrounded by the inhabitants. They didn't scramble or push to get near us, rather, they stopped what they were doing and calmly approached us. They formed a circle large enough to be comfortable and for all to have equal opportunity to see an alien face to face. Again, it struck me that these people all seemed to be of the same age, apart from about half a dozen who could have been older. Age, here, did not detract but added a quality of surprising nobility. I had also been struck by the absence of children on the planet, and yet, in this settlement and among the crowd that approached, I saw six or seven of them. They were charming and appeared to be quite level-headed for children. According to Thau, they would have been 8 or 9 years old. Since my arrival on Thiuba, I had not yet had occasion to meet so great a number of these people. Glancing around the circle, I could appreciate a calmness and reserve about them, as well as the great beauty in their faces that I'd grown to expect. There was a strong resemblance between them, as if they were all brothers and sisters, and yet, isn't that our first impression when we encounter a group of blacks or Asians together? In fact, the same physical variety in facial features existed among these people, as exists within races on Earth. In height, they varied from 280 to 300 centimeters. Their bodies being so well proportioned, they were a pleasure to behold, neither too muscular nor too puny, and without deformity of any kind. Their hips were somewhat larger than you would expect in a man, but then I'd been told that some of them gave birth to children. All possessed magnificent heads of hair, most of a golden blonde color, others platinum blonde or coppery blonde and occasionally, a bright chestnut color. There were also some, like Thau and Biastra, with a fine down of hair on the upper lip. But, apart from this, these people had absolutely no other body hair. This is not, of course, an observation that I made at the time but one which I made later, when I had occasion to see from quite near, a group of naked sunbathers. Their skin type reminded me of Arab women who protect themselves from the sun. It was certainly not the pale skin typical of blondes with such light eyes. So light, indeed, were the mauve and blue eyes around me, that I might have wondered if they were blind, had I been on Earth. When I speak now, of their long legs and rounded thighs, they reminded me of our female long-distance runners, as well as their beautifully proportioned breasts, firm and shapely in every case. The reader will understand my error in believing Thau to be a female giant when first we met. It occurred to me that women on Earth would be most envious of the breasts of these people, and men would be most delighted by them. I have already commented on the beauty of Thau's face, and others in this crowd had similar classic features, still others I would describe as charming or alluring. Each face, though slightly different in shape and features, seemed to have been designed by an artist. Each had been given its own unique charm, but, above all, the quality most evident in their faces and in their manner and deportment was the quality of intelligence. In all, I could find no fault with these people who grouped around us, beaming smiles of welcome which revealed rows of perfect white teeth. This physical perfection did not surprise me, since thou had explained their ability to regenerate their body cells at will. There was no reason, therefore, that these magnificent bodies should age. Are we interrupting them in their work? I asked Biastra, who happened to be by my side. No, not really, she replied. Most of the people in this town are on vacation. It is also a place where people come to meditate. Three of the elders approached and Thou asked that I address them in French, and loudly enough for everyone to hear. I believe I said, I am very happy to be among you and to be able to admire your wonderful planet. You are fortunate people and I, myself, would like to live among you. This speech released a concert of exclamation, not only on account of the language, which most of them had never before heard spoken, but also for the sense of what I had said, which had been telepathically communicated. Biastra signaled we should follow the three elders, who led us into one of the dokos. When the seven of us were comfortably installed, Thou began, Michelle, I would like to introduce you to Lashusi. She held her hand towards one of the three and I bowed. Lashusi was, about 14,000 of your years ago, the last king of the continent Mu on Earth. I don't understand. You don't want to understand, Michelle, and, at this particular moment, you resemble many of your peers on Earth. I must have looked troubled, for Thou, Biastra and Latli laughed loudly. Don't look like that, Michelle. I just meant to jostle you a little. Now, in the presence of Lashusi, I am going to explain one of the mysteries that elude many experts on your planet, who, I might add, would do better to devote their precious time discovering more useful things. I am going to unveil not one, but several of the mysteries which obsess them. Our seats were arranged in a circle, Thou sat next to Lashusi and I sat facing them. As I already explained during our journey to Thaya Uba, the Bakaratinians arrived on Earth, embarked on an interplanetary voyage of exploration penetrating your solar system. After having skirted Saturn, Jupiter, Mars and Mercury, they landed on the planet Earth in China, where their spacecraft caused considerable panic among the populace. Their legends refer to fire dragons descending from the sky. The fear and mistrust of the Chinese led them eventually to attack the aliens, who were forced to use violence in order to defend themselves. This they hated, for they were not only technologically advanced but also highly spiritual people who abhorred killing. They moved on, continuing their exploration of the planet. It turned out that the continent of Mu had most appeal for them for two main reasons. First, the continent appeared to be virtually uninhabited and second, by virtue of its latitude, it was a veritable paradise. They had become particularly cautious since their confrontation with the Chinese and felt it would be wise to establish a base to which they could retreat, should they encounter further hostilities of a serious nature from Earth people. I have not yet explained that their reason for exploring Earth was their intention of resettling several million people from Amo-X-3, a planet that was becoming uncomfortably overpopulated. This operation was much too serious to take risks of any kind. Thus, it was decided that their base of retreat would be set up, not on Earth, but on the Moon, which was quite close and considered very safe. 50 years were spent establishing the lunar bases and it wasn't until they were ready that emigration to Mu began. All went well. The small Chinese colony that had existed in the northwest of Mu had been totally destroyed some decades after their first visit, so in effect, they had the entire continent to themselves. Work began immediately on the construction of towns, canals and roads, which they paved with immense flagstones. Their usual means of transport was a flying chariot, not unlike our later ox. From their planet, they imported animals such as the dog and the armadillo, which they were very partial to on Amo-X-3, and also the pig. When she told me about all those imported animals, I remembered how astonished I'd been to see pigs and dogs on that famous planet during our earlier visit. Suddenly, everything was very clear to me. In height, these people averaged 180 centimeters for the males, and 160 centimeters for the females. Their hair was dark, their eyes of a beautiful black, and their skin lightly bronzed. You saw some of their kind when we stopped at Hamo X3, and I believe you have already guessed them to be the ancestors of the Polynesians. So they established settlements throughout the length and breadth of the continent, including 19 large cities, 7 of which were sacred. Small villages were also numerous, for these people were highly skilled farmers and graziers. Their political system was modeled on that of Hamo X3. They had long ago discovered that the only way to govern a country properly was to place at the head of government 7 men of integrity, representing no political party, but sincerely committed to doing what they could for their nation. The 7th among them was the supreme judge, whose vote on council was worth 2. If 4 were against him and 2 with him on a particular issue, they were at deadlock, and hours or days of debate would ensue, until at least one of the 7 was persuaded to change his vote. This debate was conducted within a context of intelligence, love, and concern for the people. These high figures received no great material benefits for leading the nation. It was their vocation to lead, and they did it for the love of serving their country. This avoided the problem of hiding opportunists among the leaders. The same can't be said of our national leaders now, I remarked with a hint of bitterness. Where were such men found? The procedure was as follows. In a village or district, a man of integrity was elected by referendum. No one with a record of bad conduct or a tendency towards fanaticism could be chosen. The chosen one would have demonstrated integrity in all spheres. He would then be sent to the nearest town, along with other representatives from neighboring villages, and there, further elections would be held. For example, if there were 60 villages, there would be 60 men elected by the people for their integrity and not for promises which they made, but couldn't keep. Representatives from all over the nation would meet together in the capital city. They would be divided into groups of 6, and each group assigned a particular conference room. For the next 10 days, the group would be together, holding discussions, sharing meals, enjoying shows, and, eventually, they would elect a group leader. So, if there had been 60 representatives, divided into 10 groups, there would be 10 group leaders. Of these 10, 7 would be elected by the same process, and from the 7, an eventual supreme leader would emerge. He was given the title of king. So, he was a republican king, I said. Thou smiled at my remark, and Lashnusi gave a slight frown. The king was elected in this way only if his predecessor died without having nominated a successor, or if the successor was not unanimously accepted by the Council of 7. He was given the title of king, first because he was the representative on earth of the Great Spirit, and second because 9 times out of 10, he would be the son or near relative of the preceding king. Something like the Roman method, then. Yes, indeed. However, if this king manifested the slightest tendency towards dictatorship, he was overthrown by his council of peers. But let's go back now to our emigrants from Hamo X3. Their capital city, given the name Savanasa, was situated on a plateau overlooking the Gulf of Suvatu. The plateau was 300 meters high and, except for 2 hills, one in the southwest and one in the southeast, this was the highest point on the continent of Mu. I'm sorry, Thou, may I interrupt? When you explained the cataclysm which knocked the Earth off its axis, you said that refuge on the Moon was not possible because it didn't exist, and yet now, you say that safety bases were established on the Moon for these emigrants. There was no Moon at the time when the blacks populated Australia, or for a very long time afterwards. There had been 2 very small moons much earlier, about 6 million years ago, which revolved around Earth, eventually colliding with it. Earth was not inhabited at the time, so, although terrible cataclysms followed, it didn't really matter. About 500,000 years ago, Earth captured a much larger moon, the one which exists now. It was passing too close to your planet and was attracted into an orbit. This often happens with moons. Further catastrophes were provoked by this event. What do you mean when you say passing too close to Earth? Why didn't it crash? And anyway, what is a moon? It could have crashed indeed, but that doesn't often happen. A moon is originally a small planet revolving around its sun in a spiral that becomes increasingly tight. The smaller planets spiral more rapidly than the larger ones, because their 7 inertial force is less. Their spiral being faster, the smaller planets often catch up to the larger planets and, if they pass too closely, the gravitational attraction of the planet will be stronger than that of the sun. The smaller planet begins southwest of the continent. The enormous stones were transported using anti-gravitational techniques well known to these people. They were carried on platforms, 20 centimeters above the paved roads, which were constructed using the same principles as those of the pyramids. Roads such as these were built all over the country, converging, like a massive spider's web, on the capital, Savanasa. The huge stones were taken to Savanasa and put into position according to directions from the master or chief architect on the project. When finished, the pyramid measured exactly 440.01 meters in height and its four faces were oriented precisely towards the four points of the compass. Was this intended to be the king's palace, or his tomb? Everyone wore the same indulgent smile that often appeared when I asked a question. Nothing of the sort, Michel. This pyramid was much more important. It was a tool. An enormous tool, I admit, but a tool just the same. So, too, was the Pyramid of Cops, in Egypt, though it was much smaller in size. A tool? Please explain, I'm no longer with you. It was true I was having trouble following thought, but I could sense one of the great mysteries was about to be revealed to me. One which had provoked so much inquiry and had been the subject of so much writing on Earth. You will have realized, Thau resumed, that these were highly advanced people. They possessed a profound understanding of universal law and used their pyramid as a captor of cosmic rays, forces and energies, as well as terrestrial energies. Inside, rooms positioned according to a precise plan, served the king and certain other great initiates as powerful communications centers, enabling telepathic addition of editor in agreement with the author, communication with other planets and other worlds in the universe. Such communication with extraterrestrials is no longer possible for people on Earth, but the people of Mu in those days, by natural means and by exploiting cosmic forces, were in constant communication with other beings and were even able to explore parallel universes. Was this the sole purpose of the pyramid? Not quite. Its second use was to make rain. By a system of plates, made of a special alloy incorporating silver as its major component, these people were able, in a few days, to cause the accumulation of clouds above the country, and so, to have rain as they needed it. Thus, they were able to create, virtually, a paradise over the whole continent. Rivers and springs never dried up, but flowed lazily across the numerous plains of a land that was essentially flat. Fruit trees were laden with fruit, bowing under the weight of oranges, mandarins or apples, according to latitude. Exotic fruits, of kinds that actually no longer exist on Earth, were harvested in abundance. One such fruit, called the lycote, possessed a property that caused an excitation of brain activity, allowing whoever ate it to solve problems which would normally be beyond them. This property was not actually a drug, but the fruit was, nevertheless, condemned by the sages. The lycote was only authorized to be planted in the gardens of the king. In writing this book, I feel it is interesting to emphasize the striking similarity between this prohibition from eating the lycote, for reasons relating to knowledge, and, in the Bible, Adam being forbidden to eat the apple on similar grounds. Authors comment, man being what he is, however, the fruit was secretly planted in various places throughout the continent. Those caught with the fruit were harshly punished for they had directly disobeyed the king of Mu. In matters of religion and government, he was to be obeyed absolutely, as he was the representative of the Great Spirit. As such, the king was not one to be worshipped. He simply represented another. Those people believed in Tharoa, the god, the spirit, the one and only, the creator, which effectively destroyed their towns and almost all that might have allowed them to advance technologically. I must emphasize the following point. Prior to embarking on their exploratory expeditions of the planet, the inhabitants of Mu had conducted research by means of the Pyramid of Savanasa. As a result of this research, it was decided to send forth the flying ships and to colonize New Guinea and the southern Asiatic region, that is, all to the west of Mu. Simultaneously, they set up colonies in South America and Central America. Most importantly, they established a colonial base, which grew into a huge town, in the area known to your archaeologists as Theocuano 1, located not far from Lake Titicaca. The Andes did not exist at the time, the mountains formed some time later, as you will soon see. At Theocuano, an enormous seaport was built. In those days, North and South America were flat and eventually, a canal was constructed to link an inland sea, existing where Brazil is now, with the Pacific Ocean. This sea also had an outlet into the Atlantic Ocean, so that it was possible to pass from one ocean to the other and so, to colonize the continent of Atlantis. But you say they had flying ships, why wouldn't they use them? If they pierced a canal, they must have intended to use boats. They used their flying machines just as you now use aeroplanes, Michel, but for very heavy loads. They used machines of anti-gravitation, exactly like the heavy vehicles are now used on Earth. So, as I said, they colonized the continent of Atlantis. Many white people from Atlantis preferred, at the time, to emigrate to the region of Northern Europe, as they didn't accept the new government and the new religion coming from Mu. These white people set off in their sea vessels propelled by steam and wind. Indeed, the white race had discovered steam power, having passed through a period you would call prehistoric. I must also explain that Britain was not an island, at this time as it was joined to Northern Europe, and the Straits of Gibraltar didn't exist either, as Africa reached to the south of Europe. Many white people from Atlantis emigrated to North Africa, mixing with the crossbred black-yellow race of the area. Interbreeding created new races in North Africa, which have perpetuated themselves over thousands of years and which you know as Berbers, Tuaregs and others. We often visited Earth during those times. When we judged the time opportune, we went overtly, to visit the King of Mu and, according to his request or the information he gave us, we would visit the new colonies. In India, for example, or in New Guinea, the people of Mu sometimes experienced great difficulties assimilating their civilization with that already in existence. We would arrive, openly and publicly, in vessels quite like the one that brought you to Thaouba, although different in shape. Our size, which has always been large in our radiant beauty, meant that we passed as gods in the eyes of people who were not greatly advanced and, in some cases, were even cannibals. According to our mission, it was important that we impress as friendly gods in the eyes of the colonizers so that war could be avoided, something which they abhorred on account of their advancement, their beliefs and their religion. It is because of our frequent visits, during this period, that there are so many legends on Earth, describing giants and chariots of fire from the heavens. We were great friends with the inhabitants of Mu and my astral entity at the time existed in a body quite similar to the one I'm wearing now. Artists and sculptors gave us much consideration. They consulted the King of Mu and, with his consent, worked to immortalize us. The immense statues at Hilton Hilton, Easter Island, were situated at the southeast of the continent of Mu, are examples of such work. They were, for the civilization of the time, the ultimate of great art, being in size and shape what you would describe as stylized. When one or the other of these captains is at sea, he will always find that a significant number of his crew are fundamentally opposed to his having command, so there is always a significant risk of mutiny. Of course, this is not the method by which a captain achieves his command, fortunately. I merely wish to illustrate the dangers that are inherent in electing leaders on the basis of political bias rather than from their ability to lead people, honestly, in appropriate directions. While on the subject, I must emphasize another point. When our captain-elect is at sea, he is the one and only leader of the vessel, whereas, when a party leader is elected as head of state, he is immediately confronted with a leader of the opposition. From the very beginning of his leadership, decisions are good or bad, he will be systematically criticized by an party bent on his demise. How can a country be properly governed under such a system, Michel? Do you have a solution? Of course, and it has already been described to you. The only solution is to follow the example of the government of Mu. This is to place as head of state a leader whose unique goal is the well-being of the people, a leader not motivated by false pride or party and personal pecuniary ambition, to do away with political parties, and the resentment, the grudges, the hatred that go with them, and to hold out your hand to your neighbor, to accept him and work with him, regardless of differences you may have. He is, after all, in the same boat with you, Michel. He is part of the same village, the same town, the same nation, the same planet. What is the house which shelters you made of, Michel? Of bricks. Of wood, tiles, plaster, nails. Indeed, and what are all these materials made of? Atoms, of course. Perfect. Now these atoms, as you know, have to connect very closely in order to form a brick or any other building material. What would happen if these atoms repelled each other instead of combining as they do? Disintegration. And there we are. When you push away your neighbors, your son or your daughter, if you aren't always ready to help even those whom you don't like, you contribute to the disintegration of your civilization. And this is what is happening on Earth more and more, through hate and violence. Consider two examples well known to all on your planet, which prove that violence is not a solution. The first is Napoleon Bonaparte. By the use of arms he was able to conquer all of Europe, and he established, as national leaders, his own brothers to diminish the risk of treason. It is widely accepted that Napoleon was a genius and, indeed, a competent organizer and legislator since, 200 years later, many of his laws still exist in France. But what has become of his empire, Michel? It quickly disintegrated because it had been established through the use of arms. Hitler, similarly, sought to conquer Europe by force, and you know what happened there. Violence does not pay, and never will. The solution lies, rather, in love and the cultivation of minds. Have you ever noticed that, all round the world, and particularly in Europe, you had many more great writers, musicians and philosophers emerging in the 19th and early 20th centuries? Yes, I believe it is so. Do you know why? No. Because, along with the advent of electricity, the internal combustion engine, the automobile, the aeroplane and such like, the people of Earth neglected the cultivation of their spirituality and focused on the material world. Now, as the great Thoreau explained, materialism poses one of the greatest threats to your present life and your future lives. After politicians, you have the problem of journalists and reporters. There are some among them, although unfortunately rare, who try to do their job of disseminating information honestly and sincerely, attending carefully to their sources, but we are greatly alarmed that most of them seek only sensationalism. Your television stations too screen more and more scenes of violence. If those responsible were obliged to study psychology before being able to undertake such grave responsibilities, a step in the right direction would have been taken. Your reporters seem to seek and even prey on scenes of violence, murder, tragedy and disaster. We are sickened by their behavior. The leaders of a country, the journalists, in fact anyone who, by their position, is able to exert influence on the people, has an enormous responsibility towards millions of people who are no more nor less than his fellow creatures. Too often, even those who have been elected to their positions by the people, forget the obligations they have and disregard until, that is, a few months prior to a new election, when it occurs to them that the people are dissatisfied and might vote them out. This is not the case with journalists, though, as they have not needed to inspire confidence in the people in order to attain their positions, and yet they have a similar power to influence in ways which are good or bad. Indeed, they are capable of doing much good when they alert public attention to danger and injustice, and this should be their main function. To return to the need for such high-profile people to understand and apply psychology, I will give you a good example to illustrate what I mean. On TV we see the following report: a young man has just taken a rifle and killed 7 people, including 2 women and 2 young children. The reporter shows the blood stains and their bodies, adding that the killer had imitated the style of an actor, well known for his violent roles in films. And the result? The murderer is going to be proud of himself. Not only has he achieved national notoriety, he has also been compared with one of the most popular heroes of violent modern films. But, beyond that, another such madman who sees the reports and hears the commentaries of reporters who pay unwarranted attention to this odious crime, will be inspired to seek his own moment of national glory. Such a person is usually a failure, someone repressed, frustrated, inhibited, someone ignored, who yearns for recognition. He has just seen the report and he knows that all violence is reported, and sometimes exaggerated, by TV reporters and journalists.